on the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
She saw Jesus in everyone. That's what Mother Teresa's successor says about her. This week, Mother Teresa will be proclaimed a saint in Rome by Pope Francis in a ceremony expected to draw millions. This week on Register Radio, we hear from Register reporter Edward Penton about his interview with the current head of Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity. Then we'll discuss a new study on sexuality and gender identity with Joan Frawley Desmond, a senior editor for the Register. Welcome again to Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register, joined by Matthew Bunsen, a senior editor for the Register and a senior correspondent for EWTN. Thank you so much for joining us. As we all know, Mother Teresa will be proclaimed the Church's newest saint this weekend. It'll be a cause of joyous celebration from India to Italy, and of course here in the United States. To appreciate a little more about this remarkable saint, we talked to Register reporter Edward Penton. Edward began reporting on the Pope and the Vatican with Vatican Radio before becoming the Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register. He's been with us many years. He's also reported for several other news outlets, including Newsweek, Newsmax, ZNet, and many others. You can follow him on Twitter at Edward Penton or his blog at ncregister.com. Edward, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
You know, Edward, the atmosphere in Rome must be very interesting at this moment. What has it been like these last few days?
Yeah, things are gradually hotting up here, Jeanette. There's people coming from all over the world here. But today, the portrait of Mother Teresa was revealed on the facade of St. Peter's Basilica. So people are getting excited now that things are coming to a head now, and just a few days left. But there's a lot of events planned between now and then, and afterwards as well. So it's going to be a great festive time, really, here, just to celebrate the life of one of the greatest saints I think most people know, have known in their lifetime.
That's right. How many pilgrims are expected to attend the canonization?
Well, in the beatification, there were 300,000 here back in 2003, and I think they're expecting more than that. So we could perhaps get up to 500,000. But, of course, it's anyone's guess. But there's a lot of people coming, of course, from India and from Albania, where Mother Teresa was born, of course. And so there is a huge number of people and also dignitaries as well from around the world. So
sure.
It'll be very full and very busy here over the next few days.
And you mentioned that there were other kinds of events going on. Of course, the canonization happens on Sunday and at 10 o'clock Rome time, and it's broadcast on EWTN Live. That's quite early for us in the U.S., but still some people will get up and watch that. And of course, there are other things going on in Rome, though, surrounding this event. What have they been?
Yes, well, I mean, the main thing tonight is what's called a family feast for the poor. Just down the road from the Vatican on Via della Conciliazione in one of the auditoriums down there. And there's going to be a musical put on, and there's going to be lots of things, and the poor are going to be invited to that. So that's quite a big thing tonight. There's been an exhibition starting today on the life, spirit, and message of Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on just today. And then tomorrow we have three consecutive masses in three languages, Italian, English, and Spanish, one after another in the Basilica of St. Anastasia, just to commemorate and celebrate Mother Teresa's life. Interestingly, the Italian is going to be celebrated by Archbishop Angelo Comastri, who's the Archpriest of St. Peter's Basilica, who knew Mother Teresa very well, and I'm sure his homily will be an interesting one. And during all of the events, there's going to be veneration of her relics, at various times during mm-hmm. during the next week, and those will be at the events, as I say, and of course mercy is a key theme throughout the week, and also coinciding with the year of mercy is a very providential thing, and I think that was something that Pope Francis very much wanted to have.
Yeah, Edward, you had a chance to interview Sister Mary Prima, the current Superior General of the Missionaries of Charity. was ideal that you just mentioned the Year of Mercy, because Mother Teresa is being looked at as sort of the ideal saint for the Year of Mercy. As you asked Sister Prima, how is Mother Teresa so perfect for this year?
Yes, well, she says actually that mercy had become second nature for Mother Teresa, and that her whole attitude was about putting herself into the shoes of other people and loving them and accepting them as they are, which is very much the central message of this Year of Mercy, trying to bring them, as she said, to the knowledge and love of God and recognizing themselves as being precious to God. And of course, if she saw people on a negative journey, she tried to bring them to appreciate themselves as a gift of God and awakening everything in them so that they could receive love and to love others. And that was, so her whole life really was one of mercy and showing God's mercy. And another thing she also mentioned, which I think is interesting and important, is one of the famous quotes of hers, that if you're judging people, you have no time to love them. Mm. And I think she was very keen that, if they were particularly unlovable or not loving her as much, then she would love them more, and made a point of that. And that was quite strong, I thought. It was quite powerful, the thing that Sister Prima said during the interview.
Well, you're listening to Register Radio here on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. I'm Matthew Bunsen, a senior editor with the National Catholic Register, joined, of course, by my co-host, Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief. And we're talking with Edward Penton, Register reporter, about the incredible celebration this weekend for the canonization of Mother Teresa. Well, Edward, in your conversation with Sister Mary Prima, as, of course, she's the current Superior General, what was your sense of her leadership?
Of her leadership? Well, it's, yes, well, I think she's very, she struck me particularly as a very holy woman and very close to the whole, the whole charism, and she really gets the charism, of course, of the Missionaries of Charity, and I think she's just... she seemed to me ideal as a successor to Mother Teresa. And she obviously loves Mother very much. She had a great rapport with her, it seems, and interesting how she brought her to become a missionary of charity. She recounts in the interview her journey towards it, which was actually begun by reading the famous book on Mother Teresa called Something Beautiful for God, by Malcolm Muggeridge, and it was through that she first got alerted to the wonderful witness of Mother Teresa and decided to pursue it.
I love, Edward, the way that she first met Mother Teresa. Can you describe that moment that she describes in your interview?
Yes, that's right. She met her first in 1980 when she was at a Catholic day in Berlin. And Mother Teresa was addressing the young people, and she had a chance to meet her near the stage, saying that she and another woman wanted to join. And she recounts that Mother Teresa was so happy that she actually gave them an appointment in the afternoon to come and see her. And so they went to her residence, and she was with some sisters in a guest house. And she just said she was so gracious to us, and we fixed the date for entering. And then she said we would go to London as aspirants. So it all came from there, but obviously her personal touch won over Sister Prima and her companion, and they entered without any delay. So it's a lovely story.
It really is a beautiful story. It shows Mother Teresa's spontaneity, which is something that was always so important, and the way that she just made you, the person in front of her, the only person in the world at that moment, and that little story really tells, helps you realize that. Now, Sister Prima also talked a little bit about the Missionaries of Charity now, how they've developed, their mission has developed, while the charism always remains the same. What were some of the developments over these years now with the Missionaries of Charity?
Well, I think as she said, it hasn't changed so much, but it has developed, of course, because of the greater need, which she says is constant, and the need to enter into the understanding of living out of the charism. And she said that definitely hasn't been concluded with Mother's death, nor with her canonization will it be either. And so she's determined to continue developing it. The focus will, of course, always remain on the poor, but as she points out in the interview, a lot of people think that the missionaries are charity, their central focus, the centrality of it is the poor, but of course it's Jesus Christ, and she's very keen to stress that Christ is in everything that they do, and he is at the center. And, of course, their focus is on the poor, but with Christ at the center. So that's really the essence of their charism.
Of course, and I actually, I'm a volunteer with Missionaries of Charity here in Denver, and this week leading up to the canonization, they have invited everyone who volunteers or who is a part of that particular center, that parish, to come for Eucharistic adoration, and then after that for talks. And that's always who they are. It always begins with prayer and really adoration in the Mass. And that's how they centralize themselves on Christ, besides, of course, seeing Christ in the poor. So it is a central element. It was obviously, Edward, a central element of that interview with Sister Prima. I really enjoyed it, and I point our audience to ncregister.com, where they can find this interview with Sister Prima. It's there on the website, and it'll be there, of course, through the canonization and the week after at the bottom of the page. So please go and read this important interview. Edward, we're just about out of time, but is there anything else about that interview with Sister Prima that you'd like our audience to know?
Well, I just think it's important to remember how, yes, she talked about, Mother Teresa talks about, you know, you mustn't judge, when you're judging, you can't love them. But she was also very strong on, you know, judging situations, and she was very strong on abortion and the culture of death, and she spoke out very strongly against that. But she was always, as Sister Prima said, she was always a light in the darkness, a darkness of confusion and negativity. But she, I thought it was very beautiful how she says that we see many people who are preparing to come to the canonization because Mother had gone out to give them that light, the light of Christ. And now at the funeral and at the canonization, we see them coming back to her because we see her light is shining. And the light is in our hearts. And I thought
Absolutely.
That was very interesting, that the light that she gave, we'll see this weekend coming back through so many people coming to Rome to celebrate her life.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Edward, for being with us today here on Register Radio. Coming up next, we will talk with Register Senior Editor Joan Desmond about gender and sexual identity study that came out recently. This is Register Radio on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we return.
Bishop Robert Barron talks about the importance of the National Catholic Register.
You know, the Register delivers something which is extremely important because you won't get it from the mainstream media, namely the Catholic context and perspective. Sometimes the mainstream media will pretend, oh, they don't have a perspective. They're just giving the news neutrally. Well, no one does that. Everyone's got a perspective. What they often bring is a sort of secularist ideology. The National Catholic Register brings a robustly Catholic take on the world, and that's indispensably important.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Jeanette DiMello, the Register's editor-in-chief, joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen, a senior editor for the Register and a senior contributor for EWTN. We are joined now by Joan Frawley Desmond, another senior editor for the Register, and today we will discuss Joan's recent article, Not Born That Way, New Scientific Analysis Questions LGBT Orthodoxies. Joan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeanette. Always happy to be here.
For those who have yet to hear about this report, Joan, who conducted it and what did they aim to accomplish?
The report was written, it's a summary of about 200 peer-reviewed studies dealing with gender and sexuality, and it was authored by Dr. Lawrence Mayer, a scholar in residence at Johns Hopkins University, a professor of statistics and biostatistics at Arizona State University, and also Dr. Paul McHugh, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins University, who served for 25 years as the psychiatrist-in-chief at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The study is really trying to provide more information and also raise a note of caution on some of the leading, what some would call, sexual orthodoxies of the age. But whether you call them sexual orthodoxies or just questions related to gender and ideology and gender and sexuality, including issues like transgender problems, sexual orientation. And they want to try to drill in a little bit more and look at what is known and what is not known on these issues.
Yeah, it's important to point out that it's not a, you know, these people are scientists. These are people in the medical and science community. They're not culture warriors, if you will. And that's important to know when you're reading the findings of this report. What are some of the things that they find when it comes to an examination of the science that's out there?
Well, some of the issues they deal with are questions such as whether homosexuals are born that so-called born that way. Is there a genetic basis for same-sex attraction? They also are very cautious and very critical of proposals for surgical and hormonal interventions for children who identify as transgender. And they're also look more broadly at whether we're even approaching the issue of sexual orientation and gender in the proper way. For example, they note that people have different things that they mean when they use a word like sexual orientation. Are they talking about romantic attraction, sexual behavior, or some other emotional experience? And so they also think we need more precise terms when having a public debate on these matters.
Yeah, Joan, as you write, and you just noted, the report asserts that scientific evidence really doesn't support the theory that gender identity is innate, it's a fixed property of human beings, or to use that phrase, that a person might be a man trapped in a woman's body or a woman trapped in a man's body. You note, though, as well, that the authors question the adoption of various new interventions for children and teens who do not identify with their biological sex. But this is entirely contrary to what we're being told, isn't it?
Well, it is. And the thing that's shocking is that it's all happening so fast. And a lot of people think when they either hear this from an expert or when they even hear it in a government regulation that requires, let's say, schools to provide a boy who identifies as a girl rights to the girl's bathroom and vice versa, they assume there must be some scientific basis for this that they are just not aware of. The reality is, according to the authors of this, citing almost 200 studies that have been peer-reviewed, is there is no strong scientific basis for the claims that someone, you know, that someone who identifies as transgender as a child will even continue to feel to experience that same sense of identifying with the opposite sex for any length of time. They also question whether it's suitable to be affirmative of these experiences. You might be neutral. Should you actually be affirmative and facilitate a child who identifies with the opposite sex to allow them, in such cases as, you know, using that bathroom? But to be clear, Matthew, they're not getting into the details of the policy debate. What they're trying to do is bring us back to the science and say, let's be cautious about this. We don't have the answers to everything, but we don't need to jump into this without being very careful. And especially, of course, giving hormonal treatments or even surgical interventions to children when that same child might, in a couple of years, return to identifying with their own biological sex.
This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio. I am joined by Matthew Bunsen, who is a senior contributor for The Register and for EWTN, and also by Joan Frawley-Desmond, a reporter with The Register and a senior editor. She has recently written a report on a new study about sexuality and gender. Joan, this report, I was very fascinated by who it was dedicated to. This is dedicated to lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender people who identify with those names, and especially to children who are questioning their sexual identity. And I thought this was tremendous. The author clearly states that there is a concern for the mental health of this community, and that's based on science. Tell us a little bit about their findings related to the mental health of the community.
Well, Dr. Mayer makes the point that when he started to delve into the whole subject of sexuality and gender, he was shocked by the poor mental health outcomes for transgender people, for example. 40% more likely, transgender people are 40% more likely to attempt suicide in their lifetime mm-hmm. than people in the general population. And even after that person chooses, let's say, to have so-called gender reassignment surgery and now operate as somebody of the opposite sex from the sex that they were born with, they still will have a much higher rate of attempted suicide than people in the general population. There are other high levels of drug addiction, depression, and anxiety. So stepping back for a minute, you know, we have the public policy debate, which has become very radioactive in a lot of ways, and if anyone challenges some issue, let's say, like bathroom rights for transgender people, it turns into a big discussion. But let's set that aside and say, if you have this high suicide rate in this community, what is really being done for that? And are you saying that it will all be solved by providing bathroom rights? Or what is being accomplished here? So they're not dealing with the bathroom rights, but they're saying, let's get back to the science. Let's treat people who have real conditions, including suicidal tendencies, anxiety, depression, substance abuse. Let's treat these conditions, and let's question whether these public policy debates are really where we need to spend our energy. I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of it, and they seem very committed to moving the debate in that direction.
Yeah, Joan, this is obviously a very hyper-polarized topic, both within the scientific community, but also culturally and now, of course, politically. What's the feedback been on your story and also on the report?
The story has gotten a huge amount of traction online. Thousands of people have read it. It's been interesting to read the comments, too, Matthew, because we get a range of comments, as you would with anything involving gender and sexuality. You're going to get some hostile comments, you're going to get some out there comments. But I also got comments from people saying, well, you know, we don't know what to make of this. We're worried, you know, some people had children who might have gender identity issues. But they also, they're anxious. Some people are just saying, we don't know who to trust, we don't know what to believe. Other people within the scientific community left messages saying that it's very difficult to raise the kind of questions that this report is raising, because it challenges the orthodoxy, which, you know, has been present in gender studies classes in the academy, now appears to have migrated into public policy issues that, you know, literally any parent with, you know, public school child may be dealing with this in the upcoming year. So things have shifted quickly, and I think another very interesting issue that they raised was just, saying, let's just stop. Let's be cautious, let's be respectful, but let's have a real scientific discussion.
Joan, we just have about a minute left, and where do we go from here? Where do the authors of this study go from here?
I think really what people should do who care about this, whether it's individuals or parents dealing with sexual gender issues that they have that they are struggling with, that they should, you know, read this report. I think they should go back to the peer-reviewed studies cited in the report by these two scientists. And if they themselves need treatment or are looking for help with their conditions, whatever they may be, including suicidal thoughts or addiction or anxiety and depression, they should, you know, demand more answers. They should challenge. And if they feel they're not getting answers that really meet their needs, they should challenge that and keep looking to find the science that can help them solve their problems. I'm no scientist, but that's what strikes me about that. And I think to the degree that all the, you know, what we call the sexual orthodoxies in the academy that have now spilled into our mainstream lives, we should be skeptical. We should ask for more information, and we should do, you know, our own reading. And if we're not satisfied, you know, we should challenge those who say that they know best and might even advance views that seem to lack common sense. That's what I would say generally.
Sure. And, of course, we will repeat that the study is in the New Atlantis, and it's titled Sexuality and Gender. And, of course, Joan's story is on ncregister.com, and it is called Not Born That Way, New Scientific Analysis Questions LGBT Orthodoxies. And so, Joan, I thank you very much for being here for this show. And for writing this story, and I encourage our listeners to go and to read that story.
Always a pleasure, Jeanette. Thanks so much, and thank you, Matthew.
God bless.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For our producer, Jeff Burson, and my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, I'm Jeanette DiMello. Until next week, God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.